Hello, friends of Soul Kitchen. Thank you for listening to my podcast. My name is Jasper Mutsaerts. I'm an entrepreneur, adventurer, coach, and wisdom seeker. With Soul Kitchen, I interview people that inspire me. From TED speakers to social entrepreneurs, from activists to artists, from dreamers to seekers, from business people to spiritual teachers. With Soul Kitchen, I empower people to live their quest. Each episode contains a recipe for life. What is your quest? So, welcome, friends, to episode 67. Today, I'm talking with Tim van de Tillaert, who I consider a friend and also a business partner. Today, we're going to talk about mental money freedom. So, this episode is for you if you want to learn more about money, your relationship with money, and how you can have a strategic approach to it. Tim is the founder and CEO of Bookachu, a search engine for train and plane travel, seeking to transform the way we travel. And he's also a finance consultant with expertise in both the corporate as well as the NGO sector. He has been working in Central Africa, for instance, and he has a personal interest in mental money freedom and also supporting other people and become more mentally free. Today, we talk about his history with money, his advice on how you can transform your relationship with money. We will also talk about something called FIRE. And I'm interested in this topic for two reasons. One, just out of curiosity for myself. I've always been focused on my businesses, but never been so much focused on my personal finances. And the second reason, most entrepreneurs that I work with have challenges with money. It's not something we like to talk about during parties or dinners, but when you go deeper, you know, money is a source of stress for many people, but of course, it can also be a source of inspiration. So I'm very excited to introduce you to my guest today, Tim, who you've already seen in the podcast earlier. So Tim, why are you so passionate about this topic?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. I'm very passionate about it because it has brought me a lot of freedom, actually, mental freedom. I used to have not such a good relationship with money. I was at the point where many people are still, that I didn't want to talk about money, that I neglected it, that I ignored the subject. And I'm actually really grateful that I changed that. And I now have a healthy relationship with money. And I'm also passionate about it because now it's actually a fun subject for me. And I see what I can do with money and that I can make plans and that I can use it as a tool. And it's now more instrumental in my life. So I'm really happy with that. And I also like sharing it because I see many people struggle with it. And somehow we are all, or we were all in the same boat.
Well, thank you for sharing your wisdom on this topic today. And how did your journey start? Like, did you have a certain wake-up call, or did you hit rock bottom, or were your parents already interested in this topic?
No, my parents weren't, or at least they didn't really share it with me. I think subconsciously, I knew that my relationship with money was not so good. Of course, I wanted to have more money always, but I never spoke about it. I ignored the subject, and I never looked into my personal finances. So I think subconsciously, I knew that there was a problem. But a few years ago, I did some work on myself. I went into personal development. And one of the courses I took was actually on the Mindvalley platform. It was Marissa Peer, and she spoke about, it was just one sentence in between some other things she was saying. But she said, for example, money, we have got beliefs in our mind that come from our childhood. And actually the way that in your family money is perceived has a big influence on how you perceive money yourself when you're older. So she gave the example, if you are from a family that has difficulties making the end of the month, then that actually has influence on how you now perceive money when you're older. Or if you're from a really rich family in which money was never a problem, that has influence in another way. So she said that in between other sentences. And of course, I thought back, okay, what's my relationship? What is the family I come from? And how does that have influence on how I look at money, or how I ignore to look at money?
And what type of family do you come from, money-wise?
I'd say middle class. I'm from the Netherlands, and middle class in the Netherlands means that you're actually have quite some money. But more important is it how your parents actually treat money and how they speak about it with you. And as money was never really a problem for us within the family to buy things that we needed or actually that we wanted, we didn't really speak about it. So that meant for me, I thought everything is always available. Money is not a problem. So there is no need to speak about it. And when I then had my first payroll myself, my first paycheck, the first paycheck myself, I thought that is enough to do everything that I want. Well, that turned out to be the case. So I never saved any money until a few years ago. So that influence is really visible in the way that I always had an empty bank account at the end of the month, because I never looked into it and I just refused speaking about it or even thinking about it.
And what changes did you make in your personal finances so that you can now save?
The biggest change is that I'm conscious of what I spend and what I earn. That's by far the most important point. Of course, I cut on subscriptions. I do some expenses I refuse to do anymore. I pay myself first in the sense that I first do my savings. But I think that's not the most important of it. The most important is that I face my money, that I look into my finances, and that I'm happy with what I spend and that I'm happy with what I don't spend. And whenever I do any expense, even a €2 expense, I make it consciously.
And what does it mean to make it consciously, expending?
Basically, I treat every spend as a deal. Do I consider this a good deal or not? So if I wanna buy a bottle of water, then I see it's, for example, €2.30 on an airport, and then I consider it a bad deal for half a liter. And then I also look at what does a liter cost? Is that a better deal or not? And I weigh them somehow, and this goes fast. It's not that I'm standing there in line for minutes. But then I decide, okay, €2.30 is a reasonable deal. I take it. So I really see it as transactional, which it is in a sense.
Yeah. So every expense you make, you look at it as a deal, and you make it consciously. So what type of expenses have you stopped making since taking this approach?
Well, the best example is, I think, that I do not longer buy sandwiches on train stations. In the Netherlands, sandwiches on train stations are, I think, overpriced and too low quality. So I consider that a bad deal. So I do not do that anymore. Or a little bag of potato chips on a train station. If I compare that to what it costs in a supermarket, then I think it's a bad deal. So I don't do that anymore. And what I actually started doing, I think that's also fun, is paying street musicians and not just throwing a euro at them, but actually pay them a euro and enjoy the music that they make. Because I think then it's a good deal if I can also, for 1 minute, enjoy the music that they make. Then it's an awesome deal. 1 euro and you've got, well, you can stay there for 5 minutes if you want. You can listen to 3 songs if you want. But then even that expense is a conscious expense.
Yeah. I like that when you give money to something that you're conscious about it and really enjoying it. I did a course on Mindvalley called Money EQ by Ken Honda, which is on the emotional intelligence side of money. He's considered a Japanese Zen millionaire, and he interviews 12,000 millionaires about being a millionaire. And one of the things that he says, I know you're aware about it, is about the arigato, that you're when you receive money, you're grateful, but also when you spend money, you're grateful. So can you share what you have learned from Ken Honda or what your perspective is on his teachings?
There's two things that I want to take out. Let's first go to the arigato in, arigato out. So also if you spend something, when I'm in the supermarket and I have a full cart of groceries and I have to pay a certain amount, then I'm actually grateful for the fact that I do have more than €100 in my wallet or in my digital wallet to spend that. And then I look at the card again, and then I see richness. I see all fresh veggies. I see the drinks that I like, and I see all the food that I like, and then I'm actually grateful for the fact that we have money that we can exchange that. That I put in some work as a consultant or in my company, that brings me money, and then I can exchange that for food. So that's something that I really, really learned from him, being grateful at the moment you make that expense. Another thing that he said that really struck me was that he interviewed those millionaires, and he interviewed a guy that has a private jet, a small private jet, but it's a private jet. Imagine you have a private jet, and Ken Honda asked him, do you consider yourself to be rich? And the answer is no, I do not consider myself to be rich. So we all wonder, how can you not consider yourself to be rich? So Ken also asked this question, why not? And his answer is, because here on the airport, there are bigger private jets. I want a bigger private jet. I only have a modest private jet. And this really relates to being grateful for what you have. And that millionaire wasn't grateful for even the private jet he had. And it's also a bit of the if then trap. So if I have a bigger private jet, then I'm rich.
So it's about gratitude for the moment. So how do you practice gratitude for your financial situation?
It's really saying arigato. Whenever I spend something, I say arigato. Or sometimes even when I walk in my house, I take a moment and I stand still, and I'm thankful for the fact that I can live in the house that I want to live in. And I really like cooking, and I'm really happy with the cutting board that that I treated myself on. It's a real big wooden cutting board, which I really love. And every now and then, and not every day, maybe not every week, but every now and then, I look at it and I think back of when I bought it a few months ago, and then that I'm happy that I made the decision to buy it and that I had the means to buy it. Which, whenever spending, saying arigato, and every now and then irregularly thinking of an object that you have in your hands that you bought, and well, being grateful for that.
Yeah, well, it helped me since I learned about it. Now I'm more conscious about it. So whenever I spend something, I'm thinking about Ken Honda. Because it's also funny, I like the word arigato, you know, a Japanese word. And it's a nice thing, you know, when you give money to something, be grateful for it because what you receive, or also because you can support the other people. I like to tip generously. I mean, my granddad, I think he educated me that it's important to tip. And I also worked in restaurants, so that's why I tip generously. But what is your approach, given that you are, let's say, personal finance, mental money freedom expert? What's your view on tipping?
Yeah, it's a nice one. I do it consciously again. I'm a very good tipper if I really like the service, or if the food was really good, or if I really like the atmosphere and the evening was good, then I tip generously. But if I do so, then I make sure that I consciously tip in the money, and that I know that I tip generously, and that I pay for the great evening that I had. But if service is bad, then I think it's a bad deal. So then I do not tip. So I think in general, I'm an above average tipper, but I tip either zero or generously.
Either zero or generously. That's a good approach. And where does that come from? Is that because you're a little bit a principled person, or?
We could go into that, but I think it's mostly about making that conscious choice. So yeah. I do not tip the standard 10% or standard 5%. I do not have a standard in that, because then it becomes less conscious. Yeah. So I consider the evening, I consider the service, I consider the food, the restaurant, and then I make a decision on tipping generously or not tipping.
I see. Yeah, that's a beautiful approach, being conscious about it. So if people are listening and they want to know your top three pieces of advice to reach a state of mental money freedom, what will be your top three?
First of all, face your current situation. Look at your finances, for example, the past month, or wait until the end of the month and then actually look in all the expenses you did and everything you got in. And laugh about yourself, laugh about what you did, laugh again, maybe cry a little bit and laugh again on what you have spent money on last month. And also look at which money came in and try to be grateful for that. So that's the first thing, doing kind of an administration. I do it monthly, and I used to hate it because I was a bit scared of my personal finances, and now it's actually fun. The other thing is, the second thing that is, arigato in, arigato out. So whenever you receive money, put in, say arigato, and be grateful for the exchange, for example, the work you put in and then you get money back. And whenever you spend something, spend consciously. So say arigato when you're spending as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is, it's probably the most difficult one, and it's a bit more vague, but be happy with the situation that you're moving towards. So you might not be there from day one onwards that you have complete mental money freedom, but be grateful for the fact that you actually do something about it and know that you're moving towards the subject, that you're moving towards that mental freedom of money. And that actually also helps in being conscious about your spending and about how much money comes in, where you stand, that you realize how much you actually possess at a certain moment. So those are my three best tips, I would say.
So one, face your current situation, and two, be grateful. So arigato in, arigato out. Now three, be happy with the situation that you're moving towards. What is the biggest, what are the key challenges for people to face their current situation?
I think the biggest one is that we have a limited belief that money is difficult. It's a bit of a fuzzy subject, and we do not understand all of it. We do not understand how a mortgage works. We do not really understand how tax works. So people think it is difficult. And it might be true to a certain extent that there are difficult to understand financial products. But in general, the principle of money is really simple. You get money, you spend money, you decide what you do with it. Mm-hmm. And once you have a certain control on that, you can actually look into a mortgage and try to understand that. But that's not necessary to do that from the beginning. So I think the biggest hurdle is that we think money is difficult and it's fuzzy and it's for smart people to think about it. And I actually think it's not true. I think money is for everybody, and everybody understands the basics of it. And we should understand the basics of our personal finances.
Mm. And if people face their current situation and they make an overview of their income and their expenses, I know every individual is different. But what is like typical low-hanging fruit that you have noticed with people?
Subscriptions you don't use.
Mm-hmm.
That's also one of the fun things of doing your finances every month, that you see what you spend money on. And many people that haven't really looked at their finances, or that neglect their finances, do not look at their bank accounts, have a few subscriptions that they don't use anymore. And those ones you can really cut on easily. So there are subscriptions that you use. There isn't your Netflix, your Spotify that you use, but there might be a subscription for a gym that you don't use, or the €2.30s of a Photoshop subscription that you once needed and forgot about. There's definitely a few in there.
So subscriptions is low-hanging fruit. I also recognize that. Recently, something happened to my credit card, so I was actually quite lucky, because then I couldn't pay my subscription, so I got messages. Then I realized that so many subscriptions, and I have them privately, but also business, you know, Spotify, or to make surveys, or to book Calendly links, all those things. So one is subscriptions. What is kind of a second low-hanging fruit that you often see?
Yeah, I'd like to say one more thing about subscriptions. It's becoming more and more interesting, this one, because more we do more and more online, and more software companies move towards a SaaS model. Mm-hmm. So you used to buy software, but now you have a subscription of €3 a month or something like that. You take a few free trial and then you have that subscription. So that's something you really can gain on. I would also say bank costs. I think banks are sometimes a bit archaic, and your traditional banks charge quite a bit for just having an account there. And it, again, seems as little money, but it counts up. And over a year, it might actually be more than a few hundred euros if you cumulate it all. So the second would be banks. And the third one is actually things that you're not happy with. The little expenses that you do unconsciously and that you think that you need, but actually don't really need, and that don't even give you happiness. That's that little bag of potato chips on a train station.
Mm-hmm. So it's the little things in between. So it's kind of like buying stuff while you're on the go.
Yeah, we tend to be aware of our big expenses. And we can definitely speak about mortgages and about the interest percentages in there. But people tend to make those decisions consciously. And we are aware of that. And there is some gains in there, but that's not the low-hanging fruit.
I see. So the low-hanging fruit is often subscriptions, bank costs, and then the things you're not so happy with. That's interesting. If you look at a longer term perspective, because one was facing your current situation, two, arigato in, arigato out, we already discussed that, and third is be happy with the situation you're moving towards. So, can you elaborate on the concept of FIRE and your personal goal related to this?
Yeah, sure. The idea is that you first establish an amount of money that you can live off each month. So you start off with that amount and you have in mind, okay, if I have, for example, and I did this calculation, I can live off 1,500 euros a month. That means times 12. I can live off 18,000 euros a month, a year. So I only need 18,000 euros per year, and then I actually can live. I can pay my groceries and my health insurance, etc. The idea of FIRE is that you need to invest a certain amount of money in, for example, stocks or ETFs or whatever you invest in, and that from the return on that investment that you can live. So you need to come up with an investment big enough that the return on investment is 18,000 euros a month, a year. If we look at, for example, the S&P 500, typically you get 7% return on investment each year. And the idea is you pay a bit of taxes and it fluctuates a bit. So roam off only 4% a year. So that 18,000 euros that you need to live, that I need to live each year, is 4%. That means you do it times 25 and you get 450,000 euros. So if you now give me 450,000 euros, or if I have 450,000 euros now in the bank, I invest it in, let's say, the S&P 500, then I'm financially independent because I make 7% each year, more or less. I roam with 4%, which is 18,000 euros, and then I can live without doing anything but looking at that investment.
So what is your personal monetary goal? Did you elaborate that already?
Yeah, that's at 450,000 euro. That gives me 18,000 euros a year, which is the minimum I need to live.
And how did you come up with this 18,000? Because most people from the Netherlands spend more. So what have been your strategies to reduce that amount?
Yeah, it's good to say that it's the net amount indeed. Because people think of gross amounts, but this is the net amount. I already took off taxes from that investment, but it's cutting on your mortgage, on your rent, on your energy, on those recurring costs. And then I looked at what do I need for groceries, etc. And it doesn't mean that I now live off 1,500 euros a month, but I saw from my administration that is feasible, that's possible.
I see. Well, very interesting concept, and I heard about FIRE, but I don't have a monetary goal for myself, so I should set a monetary goal, right?
Indeed. Well, if you feel like that that it will help you and that you're up for it, then you should set it.
Yeah. And most people that you've met in your workshops, do they have a monetary goal, or do you see it's something that is lacking?
Yeah, lacking sounds as if they should have had it already. But I see most people don't have it yet, but people are actually intrigued by the subject. Because the idea of FIRE is that you have your hands free to do things that you only love doing.
Yeah.
And that there is no obligation to work for a certain boss, or that you do a certain job that you're not so passionate about.
And who has actually been the founder of the FIRE movement?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I learned about it, I think, through Ernst Jan Fout, and he sources a lot from Mr. Money Mustache, who still has a blog. But I don't know if there is one founder or where the group of founders come from. I honestly don't know.
And I'm curious, when did this FIRE movement rose to prominence? And if you look at the historical social developments, let's say, of humanity, why did FIRE emerge? Because sometimes a movement is also a counter-reaction. So can you put this FIRE movement a bit in the historical cultural context of humanity?
You could probably. It's not quite my field of expertise if I'm going to do that, but I could guess that. What I can say for myself, the concept of that there is this path for you paved already, that you have to work till a certain age, 67, 68, 70, whatever, and that you get a pension payment afterwards. I find it interesting that it is laid out and that people kind of followed it blindly, and I was on that path as well. Whereas the FIRE movement actually takes back control of finances of yourself, and also not being dependent on a pension being paid out by a pension fund or by social security from a certain age paid by a certain government, but actually being in control yourself. So I would almost say that it is coexisting next to the paved path that people would follow if they don't consciously think about other options.
I see. So it's kind of maybe an antidote to kind of already knowing that till you're 67, you're working and kind of taking control of your life and being conscious about it.
Yeah, indeed.
Wow. Thank you for explaining this. So how do you look about the costs that you have in your life, and what are your strategies for keeping them relatively low?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's net, the 18,000, because actually gross is the 7%, but the 18,000 is the 4%. So it's the net that you have. The biggest cost is living. The moment that you do not have a mortgage anymore, or that you do not have to pay rent anymore, then you typically cut on 1/3 of your expenses. So I cut on those costs. I also really like the idea of having solar panels and not being dependent on any energy supplier. Mm-hmm. And also not having to pay those costs. So this is again recurring cost each month. I want to cut on them. That basically I only have some health insurance and some food that I really need to survive, and then I can work for other things.
I see. And in your financial plan, will you be the owner of a house, or will you rent a house? Because a house is a big cost item for people, or potentially. Yeah.
No, I like to own the house, meaning that there's really an owning without a mortgage. So not having to pay a mortgage, not having to pay any rent. So really having no cost in that. And if you have a completely detached house, not being part of any association in which you have to also put money, that also really helps. Because I don't know about other countries, but in the Netherlands, if your house is part of a bigger block of houses, then you have to pay to an association of owners, which is also 100, 200 euros a month.
Yeah. So the financial strategy is not to pay rent and not to own a mortgage. It interests me because I've never bought a house, but sometimes I'm contemplating on it. Is it a big house, a small house? Do I rent it? Do I own it? Do I have a mortgage? So your strategy is not to have a mortgage. And I'm curious why you choose that, because many people I know have a mortgage. So what's your rationale behind choosing that strategy?
Yeah, first of all, it's the mental freedom that it gives me that I do not have an obligation to pay each month. It means that if I want to stop working for a certain period of time, I have less money that I need actually each month. But there is also a monetary thing there. If you have a mortgage of 20 or 30 year and you have a few hundred thousand euros that you actually borrow from the bank or from any financial institution, it means that there is, during the period of 20, 30 years, there's compounding, because you pay a little each month when you start, but the big chunk of the amount that you borrowed lasts for 20, 30 years. On average, you take the half. So if you have a 30-year mortgage, it means basically that half of the money you borrow for 15 years. And that means you pay interest on the first year that you borrow it, you pay interest on the second year that you borrow it, on the third, on the fourth, etc. So it's a compounding thing that there's interest on the interest on the interest. And if you have a house at face value 300,000, you end up paying 100,000, 200,000 euros more for that house if you have a mortgage rather than if you would actually pay it cash right away. Mm. So it's just a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. And is it more a rational approach or is it more emotional that you don't have this mortgage?
It's really twofold, but I think if you look at the rational thing, it's almost nuts.
Yeah, it's almost nuts to pay this amount.
Yeah.
But that means, because I've spoken with someone, if you have a mortgage, you can, of course, live in a bigger house. So does that mean that you have... you're not so interested in living in that big house, or can you still live in a big house, or what's
how does it really work? Depends on your personal situation, but the question is it the big house that you live in, or is it a bigger house that you then actually fits your income, or is it a bigger house than fits your monetary goals and your strategy towards financial independence, if that's one of the things that you're working towards. So yes, if you have a mortgage, it's a means to live in a bigger house, but a mortgage is a loan, and you can use a loan to live in a bigger house, but you can also use a loan to drive a bigger car, and you can also have a loan to have more expensive clothes. And the question is if you want that or not. I don't judge it, but I do not really like loans. Maybe it's a bit Calvinistic to say only spend what you have, but that's at least my view on it. And many people do agree with me that they shouldn't take loans, for example, to buy a mobile telephone or to buy a car. Housing seems to be the exception.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting thing. I also like the approach. I don't have any loans at this moment. In the past, I've taken a study loan. I've taken a business loan, but now I've paid it off. So yeah, I also like the idea of at some point having a house without a mortgage. We've discussed a bit the FIRE concept. We've discussed having a monetary goal. We've discussed the low-hanging fruit. At a more philosophical level, what is the difference between living according to, the FIRE approach versus living towards a more traditional approach?
It's just about making choices, and it's about having a strategy. And I would say, I would almost say being more conscious about money as well. I do not really see that I live a different life from you because I have their FIRE as a goal and you don't have that. I think we all make different choices on what we spend money on. You base them on different things than I do. That's the same for everybody. And one of the levers in my decisions is that I have that monetary goal somewhere, that there is FIRE. The biggest difference is probably that I'm more conscious of what I'm doing, and it might lead to me being happier with what I do spend and not spend. But that's a bit dangerous to say without me knowing your situation, because I think you can achieve the same without having that specific monetary goal of becoming FIRE.
Yeah, I see. And if you have money on your bank, you can invest it in different things. So you can invest in a house, in startups, in Bitcoin, in stock exchange, in real estate. Recently, I've been on a trip towards Antarctica, and there are some people with money, so I learned quite a bit about what you can do. I don't know if this is your topic of expertise, but let's say, imagine someone is listening and they have some money on the bank and wondering how to allocate their resources. What is your experience in this, or your advice, or both?
Yeah, I always hear people saying that you're not allowed to give advice. I don't know the law exactly on that. And I think it's a bit strange that you can't give advice, but well, then I have said it, if it's obligatory to say that. I think it really depends on your risk appetite, what you like doing, and it also depends on how much money or how much time you want to spend on it. There is people that really like looking at stocks. There's people that like to look at certain companies. If they're undervalued or overvalued, and they want to invest in that, or they like to invest in ETFs in a certain field, for example, in sustainable companies, because they want to support that. And there is people that do not really want to think about it, and they just put everything in the S&P 500, and that's it. So it really depends on your personal situation. And I do not want to say to anybody, you should go for ETFs, you should go for stocks, you should go for obligations, you should go for startups or for Bitcoin or other currency, whatever, because it really depends on if you want it. And I think if you start doing it, you need to understand what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So even if you're not really interested in it, put a few hours in understanding what is an ETF, what is the S&P 500, for example. And once you understand that, you can make the decision, I just put everything in there because I think it's a good choice.
Yeah, I see. So there's a different multiple options, and you can find a lot online and also learn from what other people are doing. I'm also curious, based on the workshops that you've given a few workshops through Soul Kitchen. You also participated in a public speaking academy. So I know in the future, maybe you want to do more with this. But what are some case examples of people that you've met in your workshops, and some challenges that they had or some questions that they had?
Many people actually, it's interesting, they asked the same question you just asked, what should I invest in? And that somehow is kind of a sexy topic nowadays. What should I do? Should I do Bitcoin? Should I do ETFs? And it's pretty cool that there is more attention to that subject. But I find it interesting that many people ask that question before they actually have paid off their mortgage or their loans, or that they're actually at terms with their money. So I get that a lot back. And what I also get back is takeaways that people are really happy with. And it sounds really simple with the arigato out, that people say, actually, okay, conscious spending. I never really consciously spent something when I was in a supermarket, when I had a full cart of groceries or a basket full of groceries. And also just being really grateful for that. They give that back, that they find that striking.
Mm, I see. So they start to think about investing while they haven't paid off their loans yet.
That's what I sometimes see. And I find that funny, but it also tells a lot about the subject.
Yeah. For me, it was a big milestone when I was able to sell my shares of a business and paid off my student loan. It made such a shift in my feeling, you know, like I've passed.
Did that give freedom, or how did it work out?
Freedom. It gave me a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, I don't like the feeling of having loans.
Yeah, I can relate to that. When you asked me about the mortgage, indeed, I just don't like having it. It's like being free and not being attached to any obligation.
Yeah, no, I completely resonate. It also depends where you are. For instance, in Amsterdam or London or New York, you know, a lot of people have high mortgages. But then I lived some time in Costa Rica, now Portugal. People seem to have a different mindset. They don't want to have a mortgage. They have smaller houses, live more free. For me, as an interviewer, what question did I not yet ask you that might be very relevant for this topic?
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. Let me think a little bit about it. I think we haven't really focused too much on the arigato in part. So what to do, how being grateful of the money you receive. And I've touched upon this in the workshops that I gave as well. And actually, I saw sparkling eyes as well when I said that. Just at the end of the month, when you get your payroll, if you have a job, 25th, 26th of the month, look at your bank account and see that the money came in, or look at your paycheck and be consciously grateful about it. And then I got the question, okay, but I'm an independent consultant. What should I do? I do not have that. Well, you send your invoices at the end of the month. Your clients typically pay around the 15th of the month. So do the same at the 15th. Just take a moment doing that. And maybe one more thing that we didn't speak about, but what I've been experiencing myself a lot, look at how many bank accounts, how many credit cards you have, or places where you have money. There is your PayPal account. You might have a few investments. You might have banks in different countries. Look also at them and if they are useful and if they are still instrumental to you. That's one of the things that that we didn't really touch upon. And there was one more that I wanted to say. I'll come back to that in a minute.
Yeah, I see. Well, these are very relevant topics, especially the arigato in. I think when you receive money, to be really happy about it. I'm always super grateful when I have clients that are paying me. And it's always this thing also, when do you send an invoice? Because you don't want to be you don't want to come across someone that is chasing the money. But at some point, you also want to be relaxed about it. So when I feel that I might be chasing the money, is that a real, do many people have this feeling?
What do you mean by chasing the money if invoices do not get paid? Or did you, no, do you mean that I you mean, want to actually pay?
The timing of sending an invoice. Mm-hmm. Let's say if I have done something and 1 minute later I send the invoice, it feels like I'm chasing.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I also don't want to wait too long because you just want to get it over with. But do you think more people have, is this a thing that for many more people is like a question, like when do you send the invoice and you don't want to come across as too needy, but at the same time, you just want to get it over with. So how do you feel this?
Yeah, I haven't heard of it before relating to invoices, but I think it's a broader subject of being eager or not eager. And how do I come across if I do this at this moment, whereas the whole world knows how it works and it probably works the same for everybody. To me, it gives me a lot of rest to have, and that's broader than money, to have specific times in the month when I do things. Mm-hmm. So if you know for yourself, I send invoices always the first of the month of the past month, and that's carved in marble, then you never need to worry coming across eager or whatsoever, because that's just what you do. So I would give that as an advice, just have specific times for that, and then every now and then it might be that it is just 1 minute after you actually deliver the service, but then that's how it is because you always do it and that's a coincidence.
Yeah So then you bring structure to it. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, another question I have, we talked about Ken Holdna, but are there any, we talked about Marissa Peer. Are there any other role models or teachers or people that have inspired you on your journey towards mental money freedom?
Yeah, it's actually a book that I want to mention. It's Your Money of Your Life. Mm-hmm. That has really helped me a lot. It's about the subject of FIRE, but it also touches upon some people have kind of addictions of little things they want to buy. For example, you're really into Ford Mustangs, and every time you see a small model of a Ford Mustang, you have to buy it. And it also gives you joy, and then people chase it and they buy every month a little Ford Mustang or whatever. And if you really enjoy it, then that's fine. But there is also examples of those little things that you keep on buying and buying and buying almost as a habit that do not give you the joy. That's one of the things that you can cut on as well. That's what I mentioned in their book. And in that book, Your Money or Your Life, they also mentioned that it really helps to make charts and actually see over time how much did you spend, how much did you earn, and what are your savings. And I do that myself as well. And I see from, I've been doing this now for 3 years. So if I look 3 years back in time, not only do I see that my possessions grow, which is really fun to see, but I also see the development that I made in my spending. So my spending went down and then it went up and then it went down again. There I see where I have to control and not, and also in the income. And it's really fun looking back at it, and it really gives you a lot of control as well. There's one, I can show one more thing about the book, and still it's really nice to read the book even after having me share three things out of it. There is an exercise in the book that says, calculate all the money you ever made in your life. So from when you were really little, and just make guesstimations from your first job and delivering newspapers to your first real job after school, which might have been like 15 years, and just count up how much money that is. And that's really a fun exercise to do because, then you see actually how much money you've made in your life and also how much you've spent.
Yeah, and it's more than you think, right? I think a life in the West is like 2 to 4 million during a lifetime.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy. It is crazy. Yeah. So Ernst Fout, you know, he was the former editor-in-chief of The Correspondent, which is an intellectual, newspaper or magazine. And he's also part of the FIRE movement. But then it's an interesting question that another journalist from The Correspondent, Rutger Bregman, he mentioned in one article, he wants to stimulate moral ambition, that the most talented people in this world also work on the most relevant topics. And then the FIRE movement he described as a movement that doesn't maybe have the most moral ambition because they're more focused on retiring as early as possible. So what I find interesting about you, on the one hand, you're trying to reach this FIRE goal. On the other hand, you are someone with moral ambition. So do you feel there are conflicting elements, or are they supportive to each other?
No, I would say they go perfectly together, and FIRE is a means actually to do things that you like to do, or that Rutger Bregman would call morally ambitious. So FIRE is really about getting freedom that you can put your effort into things that you want to put your effort. Maybe the word retirement has the connotation of not doing anything after you've reached that goal. But for me, FIRE and then the retirement and FIRE is giving me really the time freedom that I do not have to chase money, so to say, or not to have a job that I don't want or that I think does not really contribute to the world. But I have my hands free to do things that matter to me or that matter to the world or that make the world a better place. So I would almost say the opposite, that FIRE is a means to get to that. What did Rutger Bregman call it? Moral
ambition.
Yeah. To actually materialize that moral ambition.
Yeah. So it can work perfectly together. Of course, depends once you have reached this FIRE status, what you're doing with it.
Yeah, so and Ernst-Jan Fout also says what he struggled with a few years. He said this. So I don't know his current stand on it, but when you have reached your freedom number, you invest that. So you typically invest that into companies that still need to grow. Mm-hmm. But then there is other people working for that companies that makes the shares actually increase in value. Mm. So he sees a conflict in there. But you could also say actually that you enable those companies to grow because you invest in them.
Yeah. And if you would ever deliver a TED talk on the topic of mental money freedom, what would be the title of your talk?
It's probably just mental money freedom, because I think that's the first step that you need to make, getting at terms with your money and be mentally free of the subject, that it is not fuzzy, that's not scary, that you actually want to face it, and everything else comes after that.
Excellent. Well, Just Mental Money Freedom. That sounds like a perfect talk. I want to thank you very much for sharing your wisdom. And before we close the episode, is there one final piece of advice? Ah, the Soul Kitchen, of course, is about recipes for life.
Yeah.
So maybe I want to ask you to repeat your recipe for life that you've shared in the previous episode. And then after that, to share your recipe specifically focused on mental money freedom.
Okay, that's cool. The recipe I shared before is that that it's really cool to read a lot of recipes. So in the metaphor of cooking, reading a lot of recipes, but then at one moment, take them all together in your mind and create something of yourself with those recipes back in the mind and make your own recipe, make your own dish. And that's basically it in your personal life. It's picking a few courses, take those courses, think of them, contemplate on them, and make your own version by combining the pieces together, which works for you, and come up with your own recipe. So that would be my recipe. That's the recipe that I shared before. And if it comes to mental money freedom, it's a bit easier. It's just face it. Just face it. Start looking at your finances. Feel a little bit bad about it. Laugh about it. Cry about it. But just face it. And then try to gain control little by little using the tools that we discussed in the past hour.
I like that recipe. So you need to face your situation and then step by step improve it. I remember when I started my first business, like these tax envelopes were piling up and I was so scared. I procrastinated for a long time until I found a bookkeeper and step by step we started organizing it. But it was really an example when I had to face the situation. Well, thank you for sharing your wisdom for the second time. And thanks everyone to listening. I hope to see you soon on the next episode. And have a great day.
Cool. Thank you very much.